Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I've got a special request this week. Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington is one of NPR's most popular podcasts, and they are raising money to keep the stories coming. Stories like what happens when you take a regular person and back them up against a wall, and that moment where everything you count on disappears. If Snap has become a favorite of yours, or you've shared a Snap story, step up now and support NPR's storytelling with a beat. Make a contribution right now at snapjudgment.org, and thanks. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll preview some of the fall season's most anticipated movies as NPR film critic Bob Mondello and I recap our recent trip to the Toronto International Film Festival. Then, because fall television is almost upon us as well, we'll bring back our fall TV pool, where we take wild guesses about which of this fall's many new shows will make the steep climb to success. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And as I mentioned, with us this week is Bob Mondello. What do you do at NPR, Bob Mondello?
I watch an awful lot of movies and talk about them.
That's wonderful. We are always very happy to have Bob with us. Bob and I have just recently returned from spending a week together in the beautiful city of Toronto.
Oh, my Lord. We saw so many movies.
What did you love the most? If you brought back one and said, I just want to tell everybody to see this.
Mr. Turner. Oh, my God. Mr. Turner is a movie about J.M.W. Turner, the landscape painter who mostly painted pictures of boats. He's English. He's played by Tim Spall. And the picture was made by Mike Lee, and it looks like his paintings. I mean, the light is almost exactly what it is in those paintings. And every time somebody looks out a window, all you can see is the frame and what's in the frame of the window or a door. And it's the most gorgeous movie.
Yeah.
It's also, Tim Spall spends the entire picture going, and after a while, the movie is about phlegm as much as it's about anything else. It is so weird. And the performance, after a while, you can sort of interpret his as opposed to his...
Hey, Bob, can you stop doing that?
All right. And he's spitting on the paintings and smearing it around and stuff. It's just remarkable. Yeah. But it's... wow. It's just amazing.
One of the things that was interesting was that Bob and I started the festival with a film that we saw together that we really, really liked that nobody has ever heard of, like, in terms of outside of, it was at Cannes and some other stuff, but it's called Charlie's Country, and it's about an Aboriginal man who lives in an Aboriginal community, and the police are gradually cracking down. They take his gun and...
They take his spear.
And so he winds up going out into the bush to sort of live in the bush, sort of as he keeps saying, in the old way. And it's a film that I really didn't know much about going into it. It's one of those lovely discoveries that you make at a festival like this.
Well, and remember why we made that at a festival. The first picture we wanted to see didn't start until 10:30, and there was an 8:30 start for this one. So it was easy to see it first thing in the morning, and it turned out to be kind of great.
Right, and again, it's called Charlie's Country, and we liked it a lot. I'm sure it's something that for most people the availability is going to be streaming at some point. Mm-hmm. It was really good. We enjoyed it a lot.
All right, we're burying the lead here. What movie am I most going to dread having to see at Oscar season? What is the August Osage County of this year's festival?
Well, one of the things that you have to figure out is, I mean, I can tell you what some terrible movies are, but
you have to triangulate.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
What is the middle brow art house?
The terrible movie that you'll probably have to see because of Oscar season. I wonder whether it might be the Jason Reitman.
Don't say that. I didn't see it.
Jason Reitman has a movie called Men, Women, and Children, which is about how smartphones are ruining our youth.
Right.
The kids are just doing with their sexting all the time.
Right.
You know, Reitman is a guy who I knew him from Juno and I knew him from Up in the Air, both movies that I like. And then last year in Toronto, I saw Labor Day.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really not a good movie, which had Kate Winslet and Josh Brolin. And it's not a good movie, and it was poorly received. And this year, Men, Women, and Children, I mean, it's based on a novel, but it's just kind of preachy and dry. And I was really surprised how not good I thought it was, and also how really hostile to women it is. It's pretty much every problem in the movie is created by bad mommies. Every solution in the movie is eventually the result of good daddies or bad mommies coming to their senses after being embarrassed. And, you know, all the teenage boys in the movie are really into sex because it feels good and they're horny. And all the teenage girls in the movie are having sex because they feel terrible about themselves and broken and empty and feel like they have to. The girls have no natural curiosity about sex at all. The boys are constantly masturbating in their bedrooms. The girls would never do that because they have no natural desire to have sex with anyone. They just feel terrible about themselves. So
just a deep understanding of how people operate.
It really depends on how it's received because, you know, Labor Day certainly didn't come out and get a bunch of praise. So it's possible that you won't have to see it. It's also possible that you might have to see Black and White.
Oh, which, please no. Oh.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But Black and White is a movie starring Kevin Costner as a white guy who is raising his biracial granddaughter because his daughter died in childbirth and her no good boyfriend disappeared. So he and his wife were raising this daughter, and then his wife died in a car accident, right? So now there's just grandpa. There's not mom because she died. There's not grandma because she died. There's not no good boyfriend because he left. So now it's just grandpa, who's sort of a dried out old drunk. And
who is the only three-dimensional character in the entire movie.
Yeah.
And there are a whole lot of other characters, right, but most of them are black and therefore don't have a second dimension to them, let alone a third.
It's not good.
It's really annoying.
Now, your guys' take on these things is nice and nuanced, and you're talking about the films, but a lot of the coverage that comes out that we see outside of the festival is what's Oscar buzzworthy and what's not.
Right.
Yeah.
It gets reduced to that.
That's what I did. I just, what am I going to have to see?
Well, but you care because it's the stuff that you're going to have to see because it's going to be on your list.
So Cindy Adams, for example, on page 6 of the New York Post, who is the Dowager Countess of Infotainment, reduced Fox Catcher thusly. Foxcatcher is the film with Steve Carell and
Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo.
Right. To this true story of the DuPonts with a homosexual vibe. Now, I'm going to guess it's a tad reductive. Yes? Tell me that's a little reductive.
Yeah, I'd say that was a little reductive.
Yeah, Foxcatcher is based on the true story of a guy named John DuPont, who was a eccentric at best.
He fancied himself a patriot and a wrestling coach. He's a DuPont, you know, like of the DuPonts. And so he's really, really rich, and he can do pretty much whatever he wants. And he got involved in the lives of two brothers who had each become separately Olympic champions in wrestling. And the story, I don't want to talk about where the story goes, although it was a very big news story in the 1990s.
It's not a huge secret, but I agree with you. It's okay not to.
But, oh my goodness, Steve Carell is amazing.
Yeah, there's always a danger in big nose acting, because what Steve Carell is doing here is big nose acting, and that he's wearing a big nose. But
you don't say. I thought that might be metaphorical.
That's
somehow.
Right.
It's
all about putty.
Literal big nose acting. But I really thought that his performance in it was interesting, and I think that once you start to hear him talk, I actually brought a clip of what he sounds like in this movie.
Athletes need role models. Like anyone, they need people to look up to.
I want more than anything to win a gold medal. And we have someone who could do that. But there are some psychological issues that we need to take care of.
What I found interesting about his performance in this is that he still sounds like himself, mm-hmm. but his cadences are very distinctive. And the way that he holds his face, I would say, is the same. He still looks like himself. His physicality still feels different. It's a really interesting performance. I do think it will be, I do think the Oscar business is, as much as I hate to go too far down that road, I don't think there's any question you're going to see those guys.
Yeah, no, it has to happen. And his performance is amazing. But that was one of the things about this festival was that you kept on seeing male performances that were remarkable. Benedict Cumberbatch in The Imitation Game, which is, he's playing Alan Turing, the guy who broke the Enigma code in World War II. And he tamps down the charisma and sort of ramps up the quirks and is a really interesting performer in that. And then Eddie Redmayne, played in The Theory of Everything, plays Stephen Hawking. It's a performance that is so physical that it almost doesn't matter that the movie around him isn't all that interesting.
Yeah.
He's gorgeous in it.
I felt sort of that way about a movie called Pawn Sacrifice, in which Tobey Maguire plays Bobby Fischer. And Pawn Sacrifice, it's kind of ordinary. If our friend Gene Demby were here, I would just say it's biopic-y, as a lot of these things are. And I think it's biopic-y in the way that sometimes Gene doesn't like, and that you get kind of a very, very conventional structure. I think Tobey Maguire's performance as Bobby Fischer is very, very good. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed watching that performance. We did see a couple of performances from women that we really liked. I think Bob and I both very much enjoyed Anna Kendrick in the last 5 years.
Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, that's not opening this fall, though. That's opening at Valentine's Day.
Right,
but
right.
It's a terrific musical. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I noticed in the screening that we were at, there were a few walkouts of that movie once people figured out not only is it a musical, but it's almost entirely sung. Mm-hmm. And so I think once people started to say, oh, they're going to sing the whole time. Oh, yeah, no. And you just saw people get up and go. But I thought it was terrific. It's pretty much a two-person piece. It's Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan, who most recently was in Smash and has been in some other stuff, but is also extremely talented. I thought they were both terrific in it. But again, as Bob says, not till Valentine's Day. So we can kick that one a little farther down the road.
Well, the other performances, though, I mean, there was a film called Cake with Jennifer Aniston in it, and she was tremendous. And
I could
think while I was watching it was that the audience seemed surprised that she was good. And at what point do we stop forcing that woman to prove she can act?
Yeah, she's got the goods.
Yeah, she was really terrific. And then Reese Witherspoon in Wild is wild.
Wild is based on Cheryl Strayed's memoir about walking 1,000 miles on the Pacific Crest Trail from somewhere in California up to somewhere in Oregon. She just backpacked by herself for several months following some personal stuff, the death of her mother and the breakup of her marriage and a drug issue. It's really a very good, I think, Reese Witherspoon performance and a good movie.
Yeah, what's kind of cool about it is that at no point does she reduce the character to somebody who's cute. She can ring that chime so effectively that it's understandable that she rings it all the time, but this is a side you haven't really seen of her.
Yeah, she really stays away from that.
Yeah, can I ask a question? Does Toronto have an audience prize, like this is the popular choice?
Yes.
Okay. This is my question. In festivals like this, even, you know, leave the audience prize aside, isn't there sort of a danger of sort of groupthink? Doesn't something like the crowd-pleasing movie, the sweet movie, the warm-hearted movie, the inspiring movie, even if it's a crowd filled with discerning critics, doesn't that have a sort of natural favorite? Like, what I'm going to ask is, how much did Boy Choir suck?
I don't think either one of us saw it.
Okay.
We had seen, Bob and I had both seen a movie called Whiplash, in which Miles Teller plays a kid who is an aspiring jazz drummer. And his jazz teacher is J.K. Simmons, right? Mm-hmm. The great and wonderful J.K. Simmons. And I think Bob and I both felt once we had seen that, it's very much a student teacher, you know, aspiring musician.
But it doesn't have a warm-hearted.
No, it doesn't.
All.
But I think we both felt like since we had seen that, we skipped Boy Choir, which is kind of weird.
Give us a quick rundown of what Boy Choir is.
This is having not seen it. That Dustin Hoffman is a teacher in a music school.
Yeah.
And who teaches a kid who's had a very rough go in life to discover the inner music within him and his creativity.
We cannot address ourselves to Boy Choir. What I can address myself to is The Judge.
Okay.
Which is the movie where Robert Downey Jr. plays an attorney. Well, to just get a feel for just how unconventional this movie's approach is, I have a little bit of this movie too.
How does it feel knowing every person you represent is guilty?
It's fine. Innocent people can't afford me.
Oh, see, it's the defense lawyer, but he has no conscience, but he works for rich guys and all that stuff. And he has to go back to the small town where he was raised because his mother had just died, and his father, played by Robert Duvall, is in crisis. And then there's an additional crisis when dad is accused of a crime. It's extremely silly. And then The weird thing about it is every single thing that you would expect them to pile on in this movie, like every time somebody goes back to their hometown to reconcile with a parent, you wind up with one of a small number of things thrown onto it to make them reconcile. This movie kind of includes all of them. It's sort of everything happens.
Sure.
That's the kind of not only heartwarming movie, but, you know, big famous actors. And it fell completely flat at that festival.
There was a heartwarming movie that really worked. And I think what was kind of neat, it's called Pride. And what was kind of cool about it was that it wasn't what anybody thought it was going to be. I went in thinking, okay, it's going to be a gay movie. And it's a...
And why did you think that? What is it about?
Well, it's about a gay group in the 1980s, Maggie Thatcher's England, which adopted a small Welsh mining town as its cause celebre during the mining strike that lasted almost a year there. And the miners didn't want the help of the gay folks because this is the 1980s. I thought that it was going to end up being mostly about that, you know, conflict.
Everybody learning to love.
And
accept.
It isn't. It's about labor relations. And it becomes really complicated and neat. And it's kind of the most engaging labor movie since Norma Rae. Mm-hmm. And that just isn't where I thought it was going to go. But it's also enormously heartwarming.
And it touches kind of on stuff. Kind of these coalition issues, right? Of trying to get activists.
People working together.
Yeah.
Stephen, do you have any movies you were particularly curious about?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. We talked about the Oscar possibilities of Steve Carell. What are the Oscar possibilities of Jon Stewart? Since we're talking about Daily Show.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Rosewater is Jon Stewart's movie about a journalist who was born in Iran but was living in London and had gone to Iran to cover the elections. And while he was there, had participated, among other things, in a little bit with Jason Jones for The Daily Show. And later, not just because of that, but it didn't help, he was arrested and he wound up being held for several months. And among other things, they showed this clip of him on The Daily Show and said, well, you know, you're on this with this comedian and you're talking about spies, because it was a very kind of sarcastic.
Well, the problem is that they
satirical.
Didn't say with this comedian. They thought the guy was a spy.
And even if they believed he was a comedian, why did he pick you and what is this about? And so that was one of the things. But it stars Gael Garcia Bernal as the journalist, who I think he's wonderful in the movie. I think the movie is really very much what I expected. There's very little in it where I think this is unusual and special. But at the same time, I think it sounds so bad when you say competent. But for a first-time director taking on kind of this big, big project that you know he feels really strongly about, it's not...
It's a pretty complicated directing job. And he did in terms of storytelling, it's really smart. It's also really funny in spots, which I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
And the humor is then sort of weaved into a story that becomes pretty dire during it. And it's... I just think it's really smart, savvy, politically aware, which you'd, of course, expect from him, storytelling. And you don't get that all the time. It could have been a much... I mean, listen, this picture, without Jon Stewart attached to it, would have absolutely no commercial value. I mean, nobody would want to see it.
I think that's right. And I think I'm probably selling it somewhat short, because for it to be sort of well and smartly executed is kind of what I expected, especially since I think everybody knows how personally he took this. Oscar-wise, for him, I certainly think a nomination's a possibility for the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll have to kind of see what happens when you get there. But I do think it's an interesting debut for him. And for all that I stand here and say, you know, I thought it was good but not necessarily great, I had a very unusual experience during that movie, which is that the woman next to me at one point was first crying a little and then crying quite a lot.
Mm.
I went into my purse. I knew I had a little pack of tissues there and gave her a tissue, and she was very, very grateful because she was really kind of starting to lose it a little bit, which sometimes happens in these very intense dramas. And it was an interesting little moment of connection. And, you know, something in that movie was really, really resonating very hard with her. And so to be fair to the movie, I think it definitely has that punch.
Do you find when that happens that it actually pulls you farther from connecting with the movie?
Well, here's what my conflict was. I don't want to get too far off the subject, but it was an interesting moment of thinking, I don't want to interrupt her having the experience that maybe she's supposed to be having, right? maybe she's supposed to be having this extremely intense experience, but at the same time, she was starting to sniffle a lot and snorkel a lot, and it really felt for her.
And you started getting irritated.
No, not at all. Not at all. It seemed like she felt self-conscious about sniffling and snorfling and all that stuff. She was sort of leaning over, thank you so much. And I think it was the right thing to do, but I definitely wondered about that. I wondered about, I don't want to distance either her or myself, but at the same time, maybe a little break was not a terrible thing at that moment for either one of us. But at the same time, I spoke before I left about the fact that I really was looking forward to this movie Beyond the Lights by Gina Prince-Bythewood, who did Love and Basketball, which everyone knows I love. And I really enjoyed Beyond the Lights, too. And our friend Bilal Qureshi, who was also there, who works for All Things Considered, shared my great enthusiasm for this movie, despite not necessarily being the rom-com aficionado. And that's not a rom-com. It's a romance.
Well, what,
it's a romantic drama.
Tell us about the movie.
Beyond the Lights is about a woman played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who was in Belle and also was in a spy show on NBC a long time ago. She's wonderful and fabulous and unbelievably gorgeous. She plays a pop star, basically, a rising pop star, like a Beyoncé in the making, kind of is how they pitch her a bit. And she meets a police officer one night when she's kind of in peril a bit. And she meets this police officer played by a guy named Nate Parker, who was in Red Tails, our friend Jean's least favorite movie, Red Tails, and was in The Great Debaters and has been in kind of a few things, but is really super fantastic in this movie. They're both great. It's a romance. It's a swoony romance. It's really beautifully shot. She has the most wonderful way with movies where people are not just sex scenes, although it is sex scenes, but where people are kind of physically close. She has this wonderful way of conveying intimacy, not in the, what I mean by that is sex scenes, but genuine physical intimacy and closeness. It's just a really gorgeous movie, really pretty to look at. And that's going to be a wide release, big movie. I suspect it will do really well. I hope it will do really well. It was lovely. It was just a pure pleasure to see. But I wrote about all the movies that I saw. You can find all of that at the blog at npr.org/monkeysee. Bob's stuff will roll out as these movies are being
eventually
released.
Eventually, as they're released,
yes. And we'll also provide a link to the conversation that Bob and I had with All Things Considered while we were there. So you'll have plenty of opportunities to hear what we have to say about all these movies. Now we're going to move to stuff that none of us have seen except I have seen pilots.
I was going to say,
I've seen a bunch of pilots.
Linda always has an advantage. This is our fall TV pool, and Linda always has the advantage of having gone to the Television Critics Association press tour. So she has seen a lot of these shows before the fall rolls around.
Oh, dear. So you can tell us if we're right.
Because she almost always massively screws it up.
Yep.
And picks something that gets canceled in like 5 seconds.
But last year,
last year.
I won
last
year.
I picked Masters of Sex about sexy sex havers. That is a huge, huge hit.
Okay. I picked Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I spoke to none other than Michael Schur, who makes Brooklyn Nine-Nine, who co-makes Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I told him his show had won me my TV pool, and I explained to him that also somebody picked Masters of Sex, but I said that should not count, and he said that should not count.
Yeah. That is what an unbiased source.
I was the winner, and I was the winner because I went with my heart.
Exactly.
So I will be doing that again. But
no
I'm
more impartial a judge than the showrunner of the show you picked.
That's right.
Said that you did.
That's
well.
Right. That is right. But I'm going to go last. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take last picks so y'all can have your firsties, and then I will go at the end. Steven, tell me what you are picking this year, sir.
Well, I'm really excited because that the day this podcast drops, Linda will be at the Smithsonian interviewing Shonda Rhimes on stage. Shonda
That's
Rhimes.
True.
And you will be able to ask her if she thinks I picked well in the pool, because my selection in the fall TV pool is her show called How to Get Away with Murder. And if you know me and the history of my picks on this show, I try to pick kind of sexy, zazzy, kind of soapy.
Zazzy!
Zazzy.
My first ever pick in the fall TV pool was Revenge! And I won. one that year. My second pick in the pool was Vegas, which I think should have had a dollar sign in the title, which did not do well.
Probably because it didn't have the dollar sign.
And Masters of Sex, which I think led me to a tie with
Linda.
Asterisk.
But How to Get Away with Murder, it stars Viola Davis as a law professor and her sexy students who get involved in all sorts of sexy mishaps.
Yes.
And
her students are very sexy.
It's like the all Shonda Rhimes block of
yes,
TV. It's Grey's Anatomy, which I cannot believe is still on the air. Then Scandal, and then How to Get Away with Murder, which is supposed to be, I have not seen it, but I've heard descriptions of it as pretty racy and saucy.
saucy.
I do declare.
It's rather saucy. I liked that pilot. I didn't love that pilot. I think it's one of those where it's all going to come down to where they're going with this in the future. But it was good. It was solid.
But it's also one thing that I love about it in the reading that I've done on it is in part because Viola Davis is a very, very busy film actor, each season is only going to be 15 episodes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I really like that. I think a lot of shows that, you know, because they are expected to do 22 episodes, it's one of the things that puts broadcast television at a disadvantage behind some of these cable series like a Fargo that is 10 contained episodes. And so you're able to tell a little bit tighter and more muscular story. And, you know, I've also read, like, we will resolve the big arc of the season by the end of this 15-episode arc, and if we get another one, it'll be a new story that draws on the old one.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounded like a lot of their approaches were right on, and I could definitely see it taking off. It's also just got a good title.
Yeah.
How to Get Away with Murder.
How to Get Away with Murder. There was a great moment at Press Tour when somebody asked Shonda Rhimes, like, you know, when you're picking the title of a show, this makes for a pretty unwieldy hashtag.
But I mean, Orange is the New Black has an OI and...
Right. And so they...
I can't even say it out loud.
Exactly. So they said, does that bother you? And it was so withering. She just kind of said, I don't really think about the hashtag when I'm making the show. And it was so appropriately withering. But no, I think what you say is really smart. I remember talking one time to Sean Ryan, who has made a bunch of really good shows, made The Shield and a bunch of other stuff, including Last Resort, which once was Glenn's pick in this pool and didn't go well. And one of the things he said was that in a 22-episode season, which for so long was standard on broadcast shows, invariably, somewhere around, I think he was saying episode 16, 17, 18, you're just dragging. No matter how good you are, no matter how good your show is, you're just dragging. It tends to be a dead zone. So those 13-episode, 15-episode seasons, you lose what is, for a lot of shows, dead weight space anyway. So, good pick.
I feel pretty comfortable.
I like your pick. I like your pick. How about you, Glenn Weldon?
Okay, I'm going to pick off a few that I didn't choose, as is my wont.
Okay.
So if I name the one that either of you two picked, just hold it. I'm not
going
to go into depth on each of these things. I'm just going to
tick
off. But there were four conventional sitcoms I considered. Marry Me, which we've talked about on this show before.
That was my closest contender. After I made fun of it in the live show,
it's got Happy Endings DNA, the same showrunner. It's got Casey Wilson. It's got Ken Marino. And those guys are very, very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I kind of thought about that. I thought about A to Z, which stars Ben Feldman, who I first found on a show called Drop Dead Diva. He was very good on that, kind of easy on the eyes.
He's the nipple guy on Mad Men.
Nipple guy on Mad Men, yes. And Christine Milioti. Now, longtime listeners to the show will know that I discovered her on Broadway. I discovered her.
You discovered her. I'm very impressed.
In Once, and that performance was so electrifying that was the kind of thing where it's like, this actress, I am going to follow anywhere she goes. The next thing she did was How I Met Your Mother, and I was like, anywhere but that.
Yeah.
keep going. Other places.
Mm-hmm.
All of these shows, I'm going to watch the pilot and make the decision then. Okay, John Mulaney, very funny stand-up comic. You're shaking your head. I'm worried about that. The thing that kept me from picking that was the presence of Martin Short. Martin Short is a very, very funny man. He is big. He bends space-time around him, and he's not a universal donor. You can't just slap him into a show, as we've seen with Arrested Development.
I was just going to say.
Yeah. So
John Mulaney may be my favorite stand-up right now.
Yeah.
The show is not the way to enjoy John Mulaney.
Okay.
That's what I would say.
And the last one that I was considering but didn't was Selfie. Terrible title, terrible concept. She's just a very vacuous person who just doesn't realize
he's on social media all the time.
Lots
of floating little Twitter icons and stuff like that.
Yeah, but it's Karen Gillan from Doctor Who, and I have a soft spot there. Considered Constantine, but it's on the Friday night at 10 death slot. Grimm did pretty well there, so I really like that character from the comics. The trailer looks pretty good. I do like that character's sense of humor. I'm going to tune in for that. Gotham I considered, but I'm aware of its worth. I just have a very strong feeling I know exactly what that show's going to be, what's going to be wrong with it. I like a lot of the actors on it. I just am not intrigued. Ultimately, of course, as you may already figure out, I chose this.
My name is Barry Allen. And I am the fastest man alive.
Awesome. That's The Flash, 8 p.m. Tuesday on the CW.
I love that this show seems to consist of nothing but... It's like six words.
This is the week on Pop Culture Happy Hour when we make mouth noises.
It is fascinating because on the CW site, there are four different previews, four different one-minute previews, and they range in tone from the grim and gritty, I saw my mother killed before my eyes, to something that's a lot more like, woohoo! And it's either a sign that there's a lot in the show that they can pull out or that they're spreading themselves way too thin. They don't know who the show's for. It looks fun.
There's also a 5.5-minute trailer that's been seen 17 million times on YouTube.
I have a feeling I'm pretty confident.
You're the one who did that?
I was
just Glenn Walsh.
16 million of those were Glenn.
Everything they say, the producers say, is that they know that they want it to be a lighter, fun companion to Arrow, which is a very dark and gritty show. You know, it's making me choose between shirtlessness and humor, which is the Sophie's choice, really. But I'm going to go for this. I think The Flash has what it takes.
I like that pick, and I liked that pilot. Bob Mondello.
Well, I liked it, too.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot. And it was, I thought a lot about that one, and I thought about taking whatever was going to be on opposite The Blacklist. Just hoping.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I ended up thinking that the show with the best title on this whole season, Transparent, might just do it. And it's my logic for that is that if you have a thing that's called Transparent, and it is about a parent who is trans, then it's necessarily going to be clever. Now, I don't know that that's true, but it's got Jeffrey Tambor in it. He plays a dad and a husband who is now living as a woman and who has to explain that to his family.
Yeah.
It was created by Jill Soloway, who knows a little about this subject because her own father came out as trans just about 3 years ago, and she was building a family show to start with, and she decided to build it there. I watched the trailer, and I watched a couple of different things about it, and it looks like it has possibilities.
Right.
It also looks like it's going to be a totally difficult thing to bring off.
Yeah.
But I have my fingers crossed, and apart from everything else, it will be a transformation in the way that this kind of subject matter is treated on television, because it's almost always treated as a secondary character.
Right. And I was talking to one of my critic friends the other day about the fact that the pronouns on this one are very complicated, because when you begin the show, they sort of save it for the end that Jeffrey Tambor is going to be playing this transgender woman. And so you really do want to explain that these kids are relating to this character as their father. You know, you're not trying to misgender the person when you're saying him, because early in the show, they haven't really revealed that, so it feels strange. But I think that over the course of the show, that will get a little bit easier, because I think pretty clearly the fact that he's playing a woman is a little clearer from the show's perspective. But it's very challenging to write about with the pilot, because you want to respect what the character is doing and the way that the character is relating to the kids. But this is an Amazon show.
I was going to say, this is not a network show either.
Right. This is an Amazon show. And I saw the pilot. I saw panel discussion about it at Press Tour, which I thought was exceptionally smart. There are some really interesting people on this show, in addition to Tambor. Among others, Gabby Hoffman is on this show, who is having this fantastic resurgence with a bunch of really interesting roles, and she was great at this panel. She plays one of the kids, and it's just a really smart show. I like that.
And what is the tone like? Is it
The tone is tricky. I mean, yeah. I think the tone is there are elements of humor in it, but it's really a family story.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I think you'll probably 100%. Really, I think you'll really enjoy it.
Now, measuring the success of a streaming show is going to be difficult because there's no such thing as ratings.
Well,
no,
then I'll be right and the rest of you will.
That's right.
That's the way
right.
that works.
That's right. I had a couple of possibilities. One that barely didn't make the cut for me was a show that I really liked a lot called Jane the Virgin, which is on the CW. And it's based on a telenovela, so it has what people would think of as kind of your over-the-top telenovela plot. And so it involves a young woman who has never had sex and turns up pregnant because she was accidentally inseminated at the OBGYNs. It's a long story. And so
actually, I think you just told me.
And yeah. So then, of course, there's the – and this is all premise. This isn't spoilers. Then, of course, there's the, you know, the guy she's with right now, and there's the guy whose sample she was inseminated with and all this other stuff. And but it's really, really good. It stars this young woman named Gina Rodriguez, who's fantastic, who's really wonderful to listen to, really smart. And so I was going to pick that one. But what I actually wound up picking was Blackish.
What you thought of Blackish, because that was one I considered too.
Blackish is a family comedy that stars Anthony Anderson and Tracy Ellis Ross and Lawrence Fishburne playing Anthony Anderson's dad. He's not really old enough to play Anthony Anderson's dad, but he does. And the premise of Blackish is basically that it's a middle-class black family where the father, and Anthony Anderson has said that this is very much inspired by his own experiences with his kids, the father is wondering whether his middle-class life is resulting in a muddying of his kids' racial identity. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty hefty thing for a comedy to be taking on, but it's really smart and really funny, and it made me laugh, and it seemed aware. And it's the kind of thing where the jokes about racial dynamics are probably would feel fairly obvious to people who spend a lot of time looking at this stuff. Mm-hmm. For a broadcast network show, it seemed actually pretty enlightened and pretty thoughtful, and the jokes are pretty pointed in some cases. There's a wonderful moment where Anthony Anderson goes to work and he's been promoted. And so he's sitting around the conference table and he's explaining how the company works. And he kind of says, look, we have this really nice company. It's reasonably racially diverse. There's a bunch of different guys. You got some diversity here. This is all kind of in voiceover. And then he says, as long as you don't really pay attention to kind of where everybody is, because it turns out then when you look at them, if you separate out, you know, regular employees and management. Mm-hmm. All of the quote unquote diverse employees are on the regular side and management is still just this wall of white dudes. For a network show, that's getting it done in terms of having something to say. So I liked it a lot. The panel was exceptionally good. The panel was just exceptionally smart. Anthony Anderson was fantastic. Yeah. Tracy Ellis Ross is really charming and, you know, really has all kinds of great things to say about her own experiences. And I just liked it a lot. And so I'm going with my heart, as I did last year I won with Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
When you tied.
And I'm picking Blackish, which I think is swell.
Okay.
Which I think is a swell, swell show.
A good mix.
Yeah, I liked it. So I hope that you will come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us about all of your hopes and dreams for fall television. And some of them will be shattered very soon, but that's cool. That's how it goes. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what the heck is making you happy this week, buddy?
Two little music-adjacent tidbits. Nothing massive. One is that my kids have just discovered Guitar Hero, and which, among other things, it means all of a sudden my kids are developing this weird ability to converse about Jane's Addiction and Pat Benatar and has ultimately led down a road that has, at least so far, it has culminated in my daughter starting a Twitter account mostly to follow Ozzy Osbourne.
Is that rewarding? Is it good?
Oh my gosh, the kids really, really love it, and it is.
Okay.
And you know, it also, you know, we're in the process of sorting my CD collection, so it's kind of fun to have a little bit more awareness. Like, oh, Dad, Black Sabbath.
Yeah. The other night we were watching Grace rock out to The Joker.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've definitely found already. Like, I enjoy when my son plays Metallica, but it's like if I have to hear the guitar solo from Hotel California one more time. The other item is a tweet that went by, and I just thought so beautifully summed up all of the kerfuffle around the U2 album Songs of Innocence being forcibly given away on iTunes as part of this big Apple announcement. And, you know, there's been a lot of hemming and hawing, and how do we feel about the fact that this retailer is able to kind of reach into our libraries and deposit something whether we want it or not, but then at the same time, it's a new, you know, it's free. This tweet is, it's been, it's a guy named Dan Weinman who tweets at D. Weinman. It has been retweeted 26,000 times as of this taping, so I'm pleased with how viral it's gone. It goes, evolution of music sales, : 1, pay a lot. 2, pay a little. 3, pay anything. 4, okay, fine, just pay once a month. 5, f*** you. Now you own a U2 album. And I just thought that is a perfect description of the state of the music industry.
I like it.
That's awesome.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, when we were talking about various TV, I kind of threw a little shade toward Martin Short for being a big guy, a big actor, a big performer. Mm-hmm. And I want to make it clear that I really love him. And to prove it, I'm going to recommend something that he put out 26 years ago, which was a television show. It was an animated television show on NBC Saturday mornings called The Completely Mental Misadventures of Ed Grimley, which is just released last year on DVD by Warner Archives. So again, by the time this television series, only 13 episodes were produced, by the time this series came out, he had developed the character of Ed Grimley at Second City, taken it to SCTV, and then to SNL. So by the time it got to, you know, Saturday morning television, it was not a character-based comedy. It was more a catchphrase-based comedy. It was just a lot of ticks and catchphrases. Why am I recommending this particular series? Because this show was a stealth reunion of SCTV. You had Martin Short, Andrea Martin, Joe Flaherty, Dave Thomas, Eugene Levy, Christopher Guest. But the main reason I'm recommending this is because the other regular on this series was Catherine O'Hara.
Catherine O'Hara guy.
The great Catherine O'Hara. Now, she plays a character who is an upstairs neighbor of Ed in this series, Miss Malone. And Catherine O'Hara gives her a kind of a breathy sex pot voice. She's always asking Ed to run lines with her as she tries to go for auditions. And the names of the plays that she auditions for is my favorite throwaway joke maybe ever. First one is she's auditioning for a play called Douse That Fire, Stranger. And this is my favorite line reading in history, where she says, I am auditioning for the role of E.D. in a new play entitled Tell the Conductor to Stop His Machine. I love it. What's better than that? Nothing. So, The Completely Mental Misadventures of Ed Grimley, available on DVD. Buy it.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. What a great pick. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week, sir?
What is making me happy this week requires a fanfare. There is a collection of American musical comedies. It is 1,500 pages, 16 American musicals from 1927 to 1969, including this one, which is Pal Joey, Showboat, As Thousands Cheer, Oklahoma, Finian's Rainbow, a whole bunch of things.
What is in this box? Is it books?
This box is two books, and it is the complete librettos, the book, basically, of each of these musicals and all the lyrics.
Wow.
Basically, for a lot of these shows, which are before most of us were going to, before all of you, but before most of us were going to musicals, there's no way to know about the book of these shows.
Right.
You basically just have the albums, right? And so I've never read the script, and it has My Fair Lady and Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. I mean, this is just sort of catnip for me. Uh-huh. I'm going to spend much more time than my husband would like reading these things. This book, it's called American Musicals. It is edited by Larry Maslon, who used to work here in Washington at Arena Stage and who is a fabulous editor. He's done a lot of things about Broadway musicals in the last 15 years. And this collection is just amazing. And because it only goes up to 1969, I'll bet you there's two more volumes coming.
Uh-huh. I bet that's right.
And it's from the Library of America. Right.
Yes.
Cool. Very cool.
The Library of America. Bob Mondello, thank you very much. I am lucky enough to have several things making me happy this week. One is that I have been corresponding with our legendary, esteemed producer emeritus, Mike Katzef, about the threat that I keep making to unveil my theme song for the NBC show The Mysteries of Laura, which I call Cop Mom, Mom Cop. And Mike was good enough to contribute what so far is my favorite subverse to Cop Mom, Mom Cop, which I love Mike so much that I'm now going to give you this one pair of lines that are Mike's. And thanks, Mike. It goes, Cop Mom, Mom Cop, got to lean in. Mom Cop, Cop Mom says your room could use some cleaning.
Nice. Nice.
And it made me so happy. And I appreciate that from Mike so much.
I do want to point out about Linda's obsession with the Cop Mom, Mom Cop theme song that earlier today, Dave Grohl was in the office and he walked through the NPR music area. Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton were interviewing him. And I go over to Linda's desk a little bit later. I'm like, oh, Dave Grohl was here. And Linda's first thing out of her mouth, can we get him to record Cop Mom, Mom Cop?
I was not serious. She has kids. She wears blue. She makes lunch and collars too. Okay, so that's my first thing. Is Mike's contributions to the Cop Mom, Mom Cop theme song. My second thing is a fantastic piece that was in the New York Review of Books called The Cult of Jeff Koons, who is an artist who does these, what they call ready-mades, which are these pieces where it's an art piece, but it's like a toilet or something like that. And it becomes art, even though it is an object that already existed. And it is written by Jed Pearl in the most recent, as of right now, New York Review of Books. And it sort of takes apart this idea of kind of upsetting or weird art and the idea that it automatically is brilliant, that things are automatically brilliant if they strike you as strange and dumb. I don't necessarily agree with everything in it, and I'm sure there are many Jeff Koons people who don't think that it comes anywhere close to giving a fair shake to his stuff. I think the writing in it is really interesting, and I just want to read this couple of sentences. I would have hoped that by now everybody agreed that not all unease is equal. Why should we imagine that because once upon a time certain gallery goers were troubled by something that they later came to admire, then it follows that anything that troubles a gallery goer is necessarily worthy of admiration? I very much agree with that. and I like the way that he got at that. So we will provide a link to that. Very much liked reading that piece. It's also good art history for people who aren't necessarily experts in art history, as right. I am not. And the final thing is I get around in my little car with the help of an app called Waze.
I know where you're going.
that gives me directions from one place to another. I appreciate them, despite the fact that sometimes they tell me to take left turns that are impossible. But they recently changed it so that you can adjust your Waze settings so that your driving instructions are barked at you by the great and good Terry Crews. And I actually have a little sample of what this sounds like when you are leaving your house.
We are ready to roll. Drop it.
So that when you're driving, all of a sudden he goes, up here at the roundabout, in the very enthusiastic way that Terry Crews goes at everything.
Yeah.
And it is truly amazing. And as my friend Alan Sepinwall pointed out, there's nothing as good as the roundabout. But as my friend Dan Feinberg pointed out, Terry Crews is always much more excited about you being at your destination than you are. And so sometimes that makes it somewhat anticlimactic when he's like, look around, you have reached your destination. You feel like, well, yeah.
The dry cleaners.
Yeah. So those are all the things that are making me happy this week. There are lots of them. I had a bunch saved up because, you know, it's been so long. And I'm very happy, of course, to be back here with all of you. And, you know, we've had a summer of lots of live shows and different shows and unusual shows and people gone, and I'm very happy to be doing a plain old ordinary show with you guys again.
Hey, nothing ordinary about it. I'm on it.
No, that's true. Absolutely right. No,
I say
show
let's never do anything again.
So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And you can follow Bob at Bob _ Mondello. And you can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy. That's REEDY. And our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, MIGAKI. And as I mentioned before, our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you were tapping your foot to right now. So thank you so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
It's a joy.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I've got a special request this week. Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington is one of NPR's most popular podcasts, and they are raising money to keep the stories coming. Stories like what happens when you take a regular person and back them up against a wall, and that moment where everything you count on disappears. If Snap has become a favorite of yours, or you've shared a Snap story, step up now and support NPR's Storytelling with a Beat. Make a contribution right now at snapjudgment.org. And thanks.